retirement, we would say, is really more of an income problem to be solved rather than an asset problem to be solved.
You've been sold the idea that financial independence is all about some number on your account statement, or even worse, that you don't qualify because of where you started out. That's just not true. It's not about some well-kept secret of the wealthy. It's about finding the right information and knowing how to apply it. On the Get Ready for the Future show, we're answering your questions so you can start making real financial change today. The journey to true financial independence begins right here, and it starts with you.
Coming to you from the sixth floor of 3 Financial Center in West Little Rock, Arkansas, this is the Get Ready for the Future show. And I'm Scott Inman. Along with me today on the show is Janet Walker, co-founder of Gen Wealth Financial Advisors. As we get set to answer your questions for the next 30 minutes about money, retirement, investments, the economy, whatever is on your mind, and we've got 4 questions teed up to do that today. But we do want to start off by telling you that if you haven't sent your question in and something is on your mind money related, it is very easy to get a question to us. We have a phone number you can call and leave a voicemail, or you can send a text message to. The number is 501-381-5228. There's also an email. It's show@getreadyforthefuture.com. So whatever's on your mind, send it in and maybe we'll get your question on the air next week. And we've got some good questions, Janet, this week, and it's going to be kind of economy driven and as it relates to the stock market and someone's investment strategy. But we're going to start off today with Mike via text message. My wife and I always managed our budget jointly, but handle our retirement and inherited assets separately. My wife decided to hire an AUM fee-based advisor. Should I join her to keep our plans in sync? Mike, thanks very much for the text message. And I think, Janet, I think we'd start here by just saying there are all types of scenarios. There are all types of situations in a household. But generally, we're going to encourage spouses to work together,
right,
when it comes to all manners of finances, but especially retirement planning.
Yeah. So one of our questions back to you, Mike, would be, you know, to ask yourself why you guys have taken a separate approach in the past. And it may be that you need to continue to take a separate approach in some ways, but there are some things that even if you want to handle your money separately, that really need to be done together as a household. And let's kind of talk about some of these situations, Scott. So it might be that, you know, you guys are on a second marriage, and so maybe you have what I'll call a Brady Bunch, you know, blended family. You've got his kids and her kids, and that impacts inheritance and what all of that looks like. But one of the things that comes to my mind is Social Security, that regardless of how you feel about handling your investments separately, Social Security really is a household question. And Mike, I don't feel like the Social Security Administration does a really good job of explaining that to people. You get your statement and your wife gets her statement, and there's nothing that you get without asking for it that says, oh, by the way, there's this claiming strategy that involves the spouse's benefit. So it really is important in that way, and some others that we're about to talk about, to look at this from a household perspective, Scott.
Yeah, and I think that it is important to draw a line between the way the assets are titled, whose possession they are, and how they get incorporated into an overall retirement income plan. So certainly your retirement accounts are going to stay separate in terms of your wife's name is going to be on hers and your name is going to be on yours. And that cannot change. An IRA remains titled in the name of the person who opens it, because that has got to be dealt with from a required minimum distribution standpoint, which is tied to your age and your life expectancy. So that's going to stay in individually registered names. And I do think inherited assets are a little bit different. So I would also go that route too, because if you've inherited that, if let's say Mike has inherited money directly from his parents, then I do think that that money might have a purpose that is different than the overall household, right? So that could be a one-off situation as well. So there are some variables in that, but when it comes to the overall retirement plan, you know, I think it's natural to make a transition into retirement income planning together, especially if you, as you tell us, you're already managing your budget jointly. So you're used to working together on spending and developing that plan. And retirement is essentially an income problem, not an asset problem. So you have to work through the expenses of your retirement, what you're going to have to be dealing with there, and to come to an agreement on what your desired income is going to be. What does retirement look like? What do you want to do? How do you want to spend your time? And that helps determine the cost of retirement.
Absolutely. So it's really important to just begin to have those conversations as a couple. And, you know, Scott, sometimes we still have people who will, even if they're on the same page and understanding the spouse's investments and that type of thing, that they want to handle those differently for whatever reason. So we want to be respectful of that, but also to help you understand that at the end of the day, this is money that will be coming into the household to cover the household expenses. And there are some variables that are really impacted by the spouse.
Yeah. So the retirement income plan certainly needs to be built from a household perspective and including both of you on that. So I do want to kind of get to the second half of the question as well. And that's the part that he says, my wife decided to hire an AUM fee-based advisor. And should I join her or to keep our plans in sync? I do think generally using the same advisor and consolidating all of that under one umbrella makes sense. But I do want to kind of speak to the AUM fee-based advisor. People who are listening or watching online may not exactly understand what that means, but AUM is an acronym. It stands for Assets Under Management. And the AUM fee-based is basically the advisor is charging a fee as a percentage of the assets under management. So for instance, if there's $100,000 being managed, they might be charging a 1% annual fee on the balance, which would be $1,000. So you're paying that advisor for the management of the investments and potentially some planning. So the advisor would charge fees as a percentage of those assets managed. But that's not the only type of fee arrangement, and it doesn't mean it's always best for every dollar that you have invested.
You're exactly on point, Scott. I think it's important for investors to understand that your advisor, in my opinion, should be able to make a choice on how you pay them, meaning you pay them in the least expensive way possible relative to the investment that you're getting. So let me give you some examples. And I'm not recommending any particular investment here. It's just I'm going to use some examples so you understand the difference in how an advisor is compensated. So an advisor is either going to be compensated on fee-based, which Scott has already talked about some, or on a commission basis. We at GenWealth do not believe that one is good and the other is bad. It depends on how you're going to utilize the investment. So I'll use real estate as an example. We have, for a long period of time, for a portion of a retiree's plan, we will often use something called a non-traded REIT, a real estate investment trust. Again, I'm not making a recommendation, just talking about the compensation on this. So if you're going to buy a building, then do you want to buy it one day and sell it the next, or even buy it one day and sell it in a few months? You're not looking in this aspect of your portfolio. You're not looking for a quick turnaround on this investment. This is more of a buy and hold approach. So do you want to pay your advisor a one-time commission, or do you want to pay them a percentage of that each year for maybe a 10-year hold? So in that example, the least expensive way for you to own that is on a commission basis rather than on a fee basis. Now let's flip that. And let's say that you have some investments that are going to be traded regularly. You're looking for very active management. So an advisor might buy or sell frequently in that account. In that case, you don't want to pay a commission because you don't want them going, hey, if I do this, I mean, I really think you need to sell this one and buy that one. But if we do that, it's going to cost you money just to do the buy and the sell. So in that case, it's better to have a fee-based approach. So that's the reason behind our thought on not thinking that one is inherently good or bad and the other is the opposite, but there is a time and a place for each approach, and it's very important that you understand the pros and cons of both.
So back to that question, I would encourage Mike to focus more on the services that are being provided than on how they are going to be charged fees. And for instance, are you receiving a written retirement plan as a part of those services from that advisor? how the advisor is compensated matters less than what the advisor is going to do for you. And we do believe, as planners here at GenWealth, that the plan should dictate the investment strategy and even the type of account potentially that the investments are held in. So I'd work through that, make sure that your wife has chosen well there. And then if she has, certainly I think I would recommend keeping the plan in sync by having the same advisor to work with, because it is a relationship at the end of the day, and working on working with an advisor that has both spouses in the same room with them makes sense for sure. So, Mike, thanks for the question. Next up, it's Gail from Little Rock. I've got $2.8 million in retirement savings at age 57. I don't plan to retire anytime soon unless something happens where I have to, so I feel like I'm pretty set. I'm worried about inflation, though. How do I know when enough is enough? And how do I keep my money from diminishing in retirement if inflation keeps its pace? Gail, thanks very much. And first, congratulations on acquiring or accumulating $2.8 million in retirement savings by age 57. You would have to be very diligent for a long period of time to be able to do that. So kudos to you for that. And you are very prepared from an asset perspective to walk into retirement. Now, she tells us that she doesn't have any plans to retire anytime soon. So we do need to probably walk through a scenario of when is your projected retirement date? Or put a different way, when is your date of financial independence? It might be pretty close, right, with $2.8 million. But you need to set a date in the future of when am I going to begin to utilize what I have accumulated in assets as income to me, because that point in time is the first piece. And if you don't know, that's okay, but you got to start somewhere, right? Maybe it's 62, maybe it's 65, and it can always change.
And a lot of times people will pick a I'm going to be ready. And it does sound like, you know, mathematically, Gail really is ready. If you don't have a date before this, we would lean towards picking age 65. It's somewhat arbitrary, but it's also because that's when Medicare is going to kick in from a health insurance side. And there's nothing that says if you plan for age 65 that you can't continue to work beyond that date. But as Scott was indicating, pick a timeline where you say, I want to know that I'm ready to retire at that point. For me, it's 59 and a half. I plan to continue working beyond that, but I want to know that I'm absolutely ready at that point. So We would also encourage you to think about, you've looked at this in at least in this question of more of an asset perspective. We'll delve into that a little bit more. But if you came in with $2.8 million and you said, you know, I just need a very small amount of income per month, and I'm also going to have Social Security, then you're great. If you come in and you need, you know, quite a bit of income per month, and we see everything from small to large numbers on that monthly income need, if your income need is high, then you may not be in as cushy of a situation as it looks like at this point.
Yeah, so let's talk about the second part of her question. I'm worried about inflation, though. How do I know when enough is enough? Well, I think the first piece of that is we've talked about, right? We have to pick a retirement date in the future. That will allow us to see where your assets could potentially land in value based on what you're contributing and future growth. So you'll know how much you have, but knowing enough is enough is determined by the income plan. So that could be part of the equation to determine that. But to keep your money from diminishing in retirement if inflation keeps its pace, that's the second half of the question. No if there. Inflation is going to likely keep its pace over the course of your retirement. So you have to battle that in such a way that your investment strategy remains, at least with a piece of your portfolio, in a growth strategy. And I think for some retirees, this is easy to absorb, but for others, it's not, because they will talk to us oftentimes in terms of, I've got to get out of the market ahead of retirement because I don't have time to make this up, right? If I lose 20% of my portfolio, I don't have time to make it up because I'm planning to retire in the next year or so. And they view, Janet, retirement as a full stop from an investment risk perspective.
Yeah, we've seen people view it as a full stop. We've also seen people view, like, there's no yield sign, there's no nothing. They just keep on going because the recency bias of if there's been a really good market, they think that's just going to continue. Things will always change. One direction or the other, things will always change. And I think this is a good place to share a story from years ago in GenWealth history. There was a lady, she didn't come to us until 2007. For today, we're going to call her Linda. We share her story in our book as well. But when she came to us in 2007, she was in a very different situation than when her retirement actually began. Linda was able to accumulate $1.3 million by the age of 50, and she decided to retire early. Now, when you retire before 59 and a half, and Gail, this is you for a little bit longer at age 57, when you retire before 59 and a half and you're taking income from your retirement assets, then there are some restrictions about how you do that. The IRS has some rules about you do a calculation and you have a set amount of income that once you start taking it, you have to take that amount, substantially equal periodic payments is what it's referred to, until either 5 years or to age 60, whichever is longer. You do have an opportunity to change it once, but only once. And again, it's still tied to only a few ways to calculate that dollar amount that you withdraw. So Linda had started taking income from her $1.3 million at age 50, but here's the key. That was in the year 2000. It had followed, you know, the roaring 90s, if you will, when everything was on fire in the market. It was fabulous. But 2000 was the first of the 2000, 2001, and 2002. Those were the three worst years our country had seen since the Great Depression. So, Scott, we had there what we refer to as sequence of return risk. She retired into a down market and didn't know it at the beginning of 2000. So she went through those 3 years that were pretty atrocious in the market and was depleting those assets rather rapidly, because there had not been a plan put in place for her to be able to withdraw income regardless of what the market gave her in return. So her returns were very, or her income was very dependent upon the returns that they had seen in the 90s. That's not what she retired into. So by the time she came to us in 2007, she was 57 years old. She was still tied to that required income stream, that calculation of the substantially equal periodic payments, and her $1.3 million was down to $300,000. Scott, it was the worst appointment I've ever had in my life, because I had to sit across this 57-year-old, the table from this 57-year-old grandmother and tell her, we can't help you. You're going to have to go back to work. Now, if she had come in at age 50 in 2000 with her $1.3 million, taking the approach of what we do as a flooring and bucketing strategy, Gail, that's what we do to be able to address inflation and to make sure that you're going to have that income regardless of what the markets give you, particularly early in retirement, Scott.
Yeah, so from an investment perspective, Gail, retirement is not a full stop. It is also not a keep doing what you've been doing that got you there.
Right.
The investment strategy has to change dramatically, and the control of the withdrawals is really what the bucketing strategy is all about. If you have conservative investments set up to take near-term money, then if the market goes through what it went through in 2001, 2002, 2003, that money for that 3 years is not affected. And our online viewers are seeing that bucketing strategy there. You see the first two buckets are considered a conservative investment strategy. So you're controlling that piece of your withdrawal strategy rather than just taking it out of aggressive investments. Now, the flip side of Gail's question is, how do I battle inflation? That's the growth end. The other end of the bucket is still exposed to the stock market in some diversified fashion. So if the market goes down, those assets will likely lose value in the near term. But what do we know if we keep going past 2003? This money is set up in your investment strategy to not be utilized as income. In other words, no investments are planned to be sold for potentially 15 years. Well, let's go out from 2000 to 2001, 15 years. Where would we be, right? 2015. We've had a surge of growth since that time frame. So it's built to let time heal the wounds in the market, let it continue to grow. And the reason you need to do that is, back to your inflation question, Gail, you have to be invested in asset classes that have historically outpaced the rate of inflation, because your dollar, your buying power, is going to diminish flat out. And so you have to grow beyond the rate of inflation. And there are only two asset classes in history that have done that, and that's the stock market, or stocks, and real estate.
Yeah, Gail, I think the underlying principle here is control what you can control.
Yep.
You cannot control what the markets are going to give you. You may not be able to control when you retire. Some people get that opportunity. Some people do not. What you can control is how you invest those assets relative to an income plan that should be structured so that it will work regardless of what you can't control, like the market.
You've done a great job, Gail, acquiring wealth. Now let's make a plan to make sure that you carry it on through the rest of your life with the income that you want. Gail, your question, great question. We're going to name it our question of the week. We're going to send you a free Get Ready for the Future Show Tumblr. For being the question of the week, we'd just like you to email us to show at getreadyforthefuture.com to claim it. Next up, it's Peter from Bryant. With recent economic growth, should I be more aggressive with my investments now? Or is this a sign I should be more conservative as I approach retirement? Peter, I'm going to say, first of all, let's not create an investment strategy based on signs. We don't know how old you are, and I think that matters greatly. Your risk tolerance matters greatly, but I would not look at recent economic growth, and I don't know how recent we're talking about, if we're going all the way back to COVID and since then and seeing what the market's done, or just this year, where he's attributing his belief that we're having recent economic growth. That is not in itself a sign to really change anything investment-wise. Your investment strategy should be unique to you. And if we're looking at signs, if we're looking to read the tea leaves in some way, and even if we're doing that from a very fundamental way and look at what economists are saying, I like to point out that we can't ever assume that things are as good or as bad as they may seem. Because from 2021 to 2023, what were we seeing? We were seeing high inflation. We were seeing interest rates go up by the Fed. We were seeing a majority of the country's economic minds predicting an imminent recession. And by imminent, meaning tomorrow, right? It's going to happen. Well, here we are at the end of 2024 almost, and that recession has never happened. Now, it's going to. There's going to be a recession sometime in the future. But if the best minds in the country can't agree or get it wrong, it doesn't make sense to make an investment strategy, Janet, based on where the economy is really at any given time.
Yeah, absolutely. So another thing from your question here, Peter, when you talk about being more conservative as you approach retirement, we don't know how old you are and how far out retirement is for you. And approaching retirement, some people talk about that 20 years out. Some people talk about it 2 months or 2 weeks out. We've had some people come in and tell us, I retired last week, now what? We really prefer to get ahead of it a little bit more than that, but it does happen. So what we would say is important is to, again, think about that timeline. How far away is retirement? And how do you need to begin to adjust those assets relative to an income plan, not relative to what is the economy doing or what are people saying the economy is going to do? Again, very much like we talked about in the question from Gail on our last question, it is way more about solving for your income regardless of what the investments are going to do in any short-term time period.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to bring back up the bucketing graphic if we can, Casey, because I think this is really easy to build off of the last question. So we're talking about in retirement, this is the way this needs to be set up, and your money needs to be diversified in such a way that the early buckets are conservative, the middle bucket is moderate, the outer buckets are growth. Your timeline to retirement can still fit into this, right?
Yes.
If you are 10 years away from your retirement goal, you don't need the first two conservative buckets. You need to begin to position the moderate bucket, and the rest can continue to be growth. If you're 5 years away from your retirement goal, you're going to need bucket two. You need a bucket position in moderately conservative investments so that it can waterfall down on your retirement date to that first bucket. So having that knowledge from Peter helps us begin to determine how or if he needs to be diversified in his investment strategy.
Yeah, and I think that the buckets that speak so much to what we were talking about earlier about, you know, whether retirement is a stop sign or a yield sign, mm-hmm. and it really is appropriate for you to diversify those assets before you get to the point of retirement. And diversification relative to when those dollars are going to be used, not, Scott, what we, you know, so often hear people talk about still about, you know, I've got diversification, I've got a 60-40 allocation, but if you're planning to take income from that 100% pool of investments as mm-hmm. opposed to taking it from the more conservative elements, you really are not answering the issue of how to deal with retirement income consistently in your retirement.
Yeah, and I'll finish up, Peter, with this before we move on to our final question. You know, if you do want to go after some more aggressive investments, if you're into individual stocks, if you want to really take temporary runs or look for temporary runs because the economy's good, certain sectors might do well for a short period of time, that's fine. Just don't do it with your retirement money. It's fine to have some sideline yeah. money to work that, right? But I look at it as your casino fund, right?
Yeah.
You may yep. not lose it all, but you got to be prepared for that, right? You don't want to take chances with your financial independence.
Yeah, we jokingly call it Vegas money. And if yeah. you're not a gambler, don't be offended by it. Call it Chuck E. Cheese money. You know,
right.
You're going to go in with a certain amount of money and you're going to come out with less. And that's okay. And you know that. The same needs to be true on that type of more aggressive approach to investing. You don't gamble with your mortgage payment.
Right.
You don't gamble with your grocery money. That's when it's a problem.
Thanks for the question, Peter. If you have questions for us, a reminder that you can call or text them to us at 501-381-5228. That's 501-381-5228. You can send a text with your question. You can call and leave a voicemail, and maybe you'll hear your question answered on the air. You can also send an email to show@getreadyforthefuture.com. A few minutes left on today's show. Time for our final question. It's from Seth in Hot Springs. If consumer spending starts to decline unexpectedly, how will that affect my retirement timeline or my ability to withdraw funds from my investments? Well, Seth, thanks for the question. There is going to be some decline in consumer spending somewhere along the way. So I think I would first address the question by saying don't be unexpected. Don't be surprised by that. It should be expected that somewhere along the way, consumer spending is going to decrease. And that does mean there is the potential for a slowdown in the economy, potentially even a recession, and that could lead to a stock market downturn. That is a given. I think that's, you know, it kind of goes back
yeah.
to the question from Peter. You shouldn't ever be caught off guard by any of these things that are going to happen. You know, you mentioned recency bias earlier in the show.
I think
that's where people get to is the market's going up and up, and I get it. I like to look at my own accounts and never see them go back down.
Yeah, yeah.
But you have to expect that that's going to happen. So if you can get to that mindset and understand that if you're going to invest in the market, the values are going to go down in a short term, how will that affect my retirement timeline, Seth writes, or my ability to withdraw funds from my investments? Your retirement timeline, Janet, should not be affected at all based
yeah.
on a downturn in consumer spending.
Again, it goes back to the beauty of the buckets, that mm-hmm. if you have set those buckets up to provide income at the time that you need them and those are invested accordingly, it's really irrelevant what is going on in the more growth-oriented buckets. And I'll also talk a little bit here about when the markets turn around and go the other direction, mm-hmm. Scott, I guarantee you there are going to be people who are like, oh my goodness, let's get out. And that's another beautiful thing about the buckets is staying in with a portion mm-hmm. of your assets that you don't need for a long period of time, but you are continuing to get that market exposure during that period of time. Because if you miss the best mm-hmm. days in the market, even throughout your retirement, we've got a graphic here about missing the best days in the market over a 30-year timeline. So we're talking about, really, if you retire at 65, this would take you to age 95. So this is retirement for the majority of people. If you make it that long, this is what we're looking at. So if in that 30-year period of time, If you were fully invested in the S&P, and we can't invest directly in the S&P 500, so if you were invested and you got a return comparable to the S&P 500, you're right at that 8% return. And this is from February 1st of 94, moving forward through January 1st of 24. So that's the 30-year period of time. This is what the S&P 500 index did during that period of time. But if you missed out of 30 years, if you missed the best 10 days, your 8% drops down to 5.25%. Now, that sounds like, you know, 2.74% difference. But going from 8% to 6% is a 25% reduction. So that's more than a 25% reduction. And when you start the calculations on the compounding of that, yep, it's tremendous on the dollar impact. And this one blows my mind, though, Scott. Let's look at the last one on this graphic. In 30 years, if you missed the best 50 days, so that's 1 to 2 days per year. If you missed the best 1 to 2 days per year over a 30-year time period, your positive return has now turned negative 0.86%.
Yeah.
So let me just say now, I'm just going to stand here in the pulpit and preach for a little bit. When the market turns around, not if, mm-hmm, when the market turns around, stay in, because you will have already realized that loss. It's already down before you know it. And if you just run and get out of it, Scott, we had people, yeah, after 2008 who would come to us. It was their first introduction to Gen Wealth, but they had gotten out in 2008, and they were coming to us in 2015 still in cash, and in 2017 still, yeah, in cash. So think about how much that impacted their overall retirement.
Yeah, and I think it's not on this graphic that we just looked at, but we have seen other graphics before. The reason for that is, if you think about, consumer spending starts to decline, and Seth, you jump off of the edge of the market and just say, I'm out and I'm going to wait for things to get better. Of course, perceptually, like, you think it's going to get better, yeah, right? So you think you're going to wait it out and miss all the downturn, but you probably have already ridden it down before you make that decision. And the reality is, some of the best days in the market over the last 50 years have happened in the middle of a bear market. The market has gone down, and there are some spikes inside of those bear markets, and those are some of the best days. So if you aren't invested on those days and you wait till you feel better about where things are economically, you will have already missed a lot of the best days.
Perspective from Casey, 30 years is right at 11,000 days.
Wow.
Not all of those are market days, obviously.
Right.
But that's a lot of days, and if you miss just the best 50 of them, yeah, you're negative.
And that's one of the reasons working with an advisor is behavioral as much as it is picking investments. It's holding hands with someone and saying, don't do the wrong thing at the wrong time for the wrong reason. And that would be the wrong thing at the wrong time for the wrong reason, Seth, is jump out of the market because you think things are going to head south. You heard the bell there in the background, and that means we are out of time, almost out of time for this week's show. It's time for our final thoughts, Janet.
I'm going to jump the gun before Thanksgiving and before Christmas. I'm going to talk about New Year's resolutions.
All right.
Because I know it's going to start coming up in the next few weeks. I'm not really a New Year's resolution. I'm a, like, let's do something that can actually bring change.
Yeah.
Not working out for 3 days and then quitting. But think about things that can bring change. I would say that educating yourself about your finances is a tremendous opportunity. So I would encourage you to, during the next year, throughout the next year, go to getreadyforthefuture.com/academy and look at what no-cost events we have, free educational events. We are education-driven, strategy-based, and team-delivered, and we are going to continue to bring you education about your money so that you can reach your true financial independence. So when you start talking about those things that you want to do differently next year, financial education should be on that list.
Yeah, our mission is to help people discover, protect, and share true financial independence. And that's how we do it, through the radio, through our podcasts, online, through our resources available online at our website, getreadyforthefuture.com, and through our workshops. We want you to come work with us. But if you never do, we also want you to improve your financial situation in life. Another way you can do that is to download our free 7 Steps to Unlocking Financial Independence. You can visit getreadyforthefuture.com/steps and get that for free. Download it and begin working on some of those steps. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Hope you enjoyed the questions. Hope you enjoyed the feedback and the answers we gave. And if you have a question for us, please don't hesitate to call and leave a voicemail or send a text to 501-381-5228. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Get Ready for the Future show. If you enjoy hearing from the Gen Wealth team every week, make sure and subscribe to the podcast. And if you want to help us get the word out on building toward financial independence, share the podcast with your friends and family. The Gen Wealth financial team is available to you 24/7 at info@getreadyforthefuture.com or call our offices at 866-653-PLAN. That's 866-653-7526. You should personally consult a financial advisor before making any investment, and no strategy can assure success. Securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA SIPC. Investment advice offered through Independent Advisor Alliance. Independent Advisor Alliance and Gen Wealth Financial Advisors are separate entities from LPL Financial.